Good morning, everybody. We might get underway. It's just after 9 o'clock. There may be some more people coming in, but that's fine. We'll be able to cope with that. Well, good morning and welcome to you all. My name is Jenny Anderson, Director of the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. I begin this morning by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land we are meeting on and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. What we celebrate here at the Museum of Australian Democracy is Australia's greatest achievement, its democracy. The experience is unique and cannot be found anywhere else in Australia. The reason for this is the rare combination of place and content. We show what happened in the very place most democratic decisions that shaped our nation were made. Many of you will know that this building was opened as the Provisional Parliament House in 1927, and from that time played host to crucial democratic decisions and events. Today you are gathered to discuss the establishment of the Senate committee system, which happened here in 1970, and you will be discussing the legacy and the future of that system. It is a pleasure to welcome you here today, both current and former senators, and others who worked in this building during its years as the home of the Federal Parliament. The Provisional Parliament House closed its doors in 1988 when the Parliament moved to its current home. It was reopened to the public in 1992, but it was not until 1998 that visitors to the building were provided with an interpretation of political and parliamentary history. Taking a big leap to 2006, when the building was added to the National Heritage List. And also in that year, the current government announced significant funding to expand the functions of Old Parliament House, changing from a site museum to the current Museum of Australian Democracy, and incorporating a new research centre devoted to the study of Australia's Prime Ministers. 3 years of intense planning and development followed, culminating in the launch of the museum on the 9th of May 2009, the 82nd anniversary of the building. Visitors can now experience a range of exhibitions and programs to not only discover the history of our democracy, but also engage with our present and future, while still continuing to enjoy the history and heritage of this wonderful building. I hope you also have the opportunity to explore our exhibitions during your time here or maybe return in the near future. I wish you well in your deliberations here today, and I'll now hand over to John. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm the chair of this session. My name is John Carter. You will recall that following the 2004 election, in which the coalition won a near majority in the Senate, and it was from the following year able to pass this legislation with the help of sympathetic independents. Now, as the time of the new Senate approached, I'm sure you will also recall the letters to the editors of newspapers and all the commentary that was going on, much of it full of gloomy prognostication about what was going to happen to the Senate and to its committees. It was claimed that the Senate would cease to function effectively as a house of review and as an enforcer of government accountability because the investigatory and scrutiny functions of the committee would be blunted. Now, the question arises as to whether the performance of the Senate committees during 2005-2008 was demonstrably below par, or was it the case that, as Robert Ray observed yesterday, Senate committee conventions and practices which had developed over decades and consolidated over decades were sufficiently robust to ensure their continued effectiveness, even at a time when one party had control of the Senate. Now, we're all looking forward to some interesting perspectives on this question from our two speakers today, who were in different ways involved in the committee processes during those years. Our first speaker, Claire Moore has been a Queensland Labor Senator since 2002. She's someone who has a strong interest in social policy and has been notably active on the Community Affairs Committee and other committees as well. Senator Nick Minchin has been a Liberal Senator for South Australia since 1993 and was a minister for the duration of the Howard government. But of particular relevance to this topic is that he was the deputy leader of the government in the Senate from 2003 to 2006 and leader from 2006 to 2007. In these capacities, he was, I think, strongly influential in the way that the coalition went about modifying the committee structure to achieve its ends. And I hope we will enjoy hearing some insights into these matters. Would you please welcome our first speaker, Senator Moore.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Mr. Carter. I like brief introductions. And also, I do want to acknowledge the place in which we're standing, naturally in sharing the acknowledgement of the traditional owners and my respects to all elders of all cultures. But in particular, I think Jenny told us a lot about the history of where we're standing, and no one can but be moved by feeling the history of this place and knowing where the issues about which we're talking actually were born, and I think that that is a particularly apt place for us to have our discussions today. One of the things that permeates all the debates in Hansard around any change to the Senate structure is how many times the word accountability is used. I didn't read all the Hansards, but I did read yours, Nick, in terms of the time that it did happen. But I had a look at the Hansards from 94. I had a look at the Hansards from when the changes came in 2006. And I even tried to look at the Hansard of 2009 when the changes were made again. And there was a variation in the amount of commentary that was made, also in the passion in the speeches, and as I wasn't there in 94, and I know Nick was, but I was there in 2006 and 2009, I'm not sure, as we heard yesterday from some of the speakers, how much of what we read was genuine and how much was that wonderful licence of dramatic performance that does happen in the Senate and should happen in the Senate because it makes it interesting. But accountability was mentioned in the Hansard of 2006 over 40 times in the debates around the process of the changes that were going to take place. And everybody was in agreement about the fact that there needed to be accountability. There was strong agreement that there needed to be it, just a strong disagreement in how it was going to occur. And in some ways, it actually flexed for me what's happened recently with the result of the recent election. I'm not convinced that a whole lot of people outside we who are here today actually are deeply concerned about the operations of the Senate. I think they should be, but I don't think they are. I'm not convinced a whole lot of our community knew you needed 76 seats to hold government until the recent events. They knew someone had to have the majority, but no one could work out why it was 76. And actually, I got those calls in my office. And it was just interesting to see that, something that everybody who is in Parliament saw as quite tumultuous, which was the recent election result, actually forced people in the community to have a look at the way the system operated. And my premise is that what happened in 1996 with the change in the way the committee structure was going to work in the Senate, of deep interest to those of us who were in the Senate, and also of deep interest to those of us who study the Senate, possibly through possibly then led to more interest in open debate about how the Senate operated. And I think that's something that should be tested. In fact, what I'm going to talk about today is more about more questions that can be asked rather than answers that I have. Because what we had when Senator Ellison came in and announced the changes that he was going to take to the Procedures Committee, which of course was government dominated, and then came back a few months later and reported what had happened in the Procedures Committee, what he talked about was the need for change, the need to be accountable, and the fact that after a great deal of discussion with government backbenchers in the Senate, And that was agreed by all the government speakers, that the need for the change that was being brought in 2006 came from government backbenchers in the Senate, that there was a need to be changed. And it was actually mentioned specifically by Senator Ellison and also by Senator Minchin, that that's where the driver for change came. And that there needed to be more flexibility, more accountability, and an absolute commitment from all those involved that there would be accountability and the effective action of the Senate. We had some colourful responses from people who didn't share this commitment from the government that this was the way to go. And I really do encourage people to have a look at some of the speeches, because the speeches from Senator Evans, who actually was outraged by what was happening and described it that it was a government taking control of the Senate and entrenching its power to control what the Senate does. That was what it was all about, removing effective accountability. Changing the way we were going to operate. And Senator Evans ended his comments with, "Labor is strongly opposed to the changes to the standing orders that flow from the Procedure Committee report. We think they're a backward step." In fact, his whole speech said it was a backward step. "And we pledge to reverse them." The Labor opposition then pledged to reverse these activities. I have to admit, Senator Brown went even further in his statements about what was going to happen to the operations of the Senate, and I have to admit a certain fondness for the statements of Senator Ray, which you will not be surprised about when you heard his contributions yesterday. And the focus of his speech was basically, what goes around comes around, and what you're going to do if you get us, we're going to get you back. In fact, that's basically what his speech said. And it says in it that there is an underlying compact in this place that you behave with a degree of decency. I'm not saying that you have totally exceeded that, but you should understand it. If you misuse and abuse your majority, retribution will come. And it will come, naturally. Now, I happened to be in the Senate at that stage for that speech, and there was real passion behind those words, and I cannot actually reflect that passion effectively, but you all know Senator Ray's position and the way he presents. The process was that I have to return to the question, why the changes? And we heard the little bleep from that side. We've got to go back to the way it was under Paul Keating. Really? Why? Why did you all put, and this was done with great emotion, and the finger? You always know that the point is going to be important when you actually bring in the finger. And I remember it very well because Senator Ray had one foot on the chair, which is something I can't do because I can't reach it, leaning across the chamber saying, then if it was so good in 94, why did you work so hard to change it? Why did you work so hard to change it? And the important thing in this process is that there were many people in the Senate in 2006 on both sides of the chamber who had been there in 1994. And I think that that actually brings the debate around what happened in 2006 a particular focus. Because what's happening in the Senate now, and Senator Knowles was referring to it yesterday, is that there is so much change happening that we don't have too many senators who have that long, extended knowledge of exactly what occurred in the place. People know about it through history, but they weren't there. And the passion in the debate in 2006, because there was a significant difference of opinion about what was the motivation for the change, what was the impact for the change, and who was going to be affected, was that a lot of the people, mostly men, who were sitting in that chamber in 2006 had been there in 1994. So it was a very personal debate. And you can see it. You can see it by the interchanges and even the few that Hansard pick up. Who were the key players across the room while these debates were going on? And they were all senior senators who had personal experience of the ways of changing. And I think that's really important. In terms of what happened after the changes in 2006, because as Senator Evans said in his speech, of course they were going to happen. The government had the numbers. The government had the numbers in the Procedures Committee. They had it on the floor of the Senate. So all this passionate debate about accountability and what was going to happen and why people were making the changes was in fact theatre. Because, as Evan said, it was going to happen. And there would be outrage expressed, but it was going to happen. And, of course, the day after the changes happened, the Senate continued operating the way it always does. And if you do a purely mathematical calculation of how many issues were referred to various committees, how many activities occurred, you'll see that there was not a plummeting of referrals to committees post-2006. In fact, some committees had more references. What needs to be done to scrutinise what was the real impact of the change, because we all know what the change was, in terms of government numbers, in terms of every committee that was set up would have government majority, and they would all have government chairs. The focus around what was going to occur was that, in one case, the government was saying this would cause more accountability because the government would have to work harder to ensure that people saw they were doing the right thing. People who opposed to the change were saying it was all about power and stopping any scrutiny of government action. If you were going to do a mathematical study, you would have to say that activity in all Senate committees happened apace. There was no reduction. In fact, bills continued to be referred to every Senate committee, every government-dominated Senate committee, and references referred as well. In the committee that I work in, and I'm shamelessly biased about this, that I think Unity Affairs is a splendid committee, and I'm sure everyone agrees, but in terms of focus, we continued to have a very large workload, as we've always had, and the number of bills that we looked at actually increased in this period. It increased further under the next government. What did change was references. And the four references that were given to the community affairs under this government period of dominance were all government references. They were really important references, and I don't think we shouldn't have done any of them. But none of them came from opposition or Green senators or Democrat senators at the time, none of them. They were all government-negotiated references, and they were important, but the issue remains whether, in fact, they were the most important issues to be addressed at that time. And I can't speak for other committees, but I think all the work that was done was valuable, but they were all government-approved processes, which they would have to be anyway, because the Senate committees operate from the Senate, by the Senate, to the Senate, so that when the government had the numbers on the floor of the Senate, they already had the ability to determine which references would be taken up, because you have to go to the Senate and say, we actually support referring this issue to, when we have a look at the Reds every day, we're always seeing what could be referred to community affairs, which shows our concern about our workload, but we see what's coming. So a vote of the Senate to determine whether something was going to agree would automatically be determined by the Senate. But what has not been scrutinised, I think, and what I think would be a fascinating topic for anyone wanting to do a master's or a PhD in this area, would be to have a look at across the Senate committees what were the references and who brought them up and what was the outcome of them. I also think it would be extremely interesting to have a look, and this came up briefly in conversation yesterday, about timeframes for consideration. One of the things with which we're constantly struggling with the Senate process is allowing effective time for any consideration of Senate activity. And I do know, with a little bit of scrutiny, that there were very short timeframes, particularly for Ledge inquiries during that Parliament. I state immediately there are very short times for Ledge inquiries under this Parliament. So what I cannot make is an argument saying it was shorter in the 41st Parliament than it was in any other. But I think it could be considered if people think that this is something that should be studied. Certainly I do want to talk about one particular issue, and that was the issue of the Northern Territory intervention legislation. That was one that I felt very strongly about, and that was rushed through Parliament with only one day's hearing on one of the most significant pieces of legislation that I think had come before the Parliament, and we heard yesterday as well, with no availability or acceptance to bring people that we thought should have been heard, had their voices heard before the debate in that hearing. And I think that's also something that should be subject to scrutiny to check out the accountability issue. But I also think if you're going to be fair, scrutinising what happened under this three-year period of government dominance in the Senate, you should be scrutinising periods on either side. So it's a large body of work, but I think it would be really exciting for someone to do it. And that is one of the things I'm asking about now. In terms of another issue of accountability, where I can't draw an immediate comparison between what happened under government dominance and what happened when there was not government dominance of the Senate process, is the government response times. There's a convention that government responses to Senate inquiries should be within 3 months. That is just a joke. I mean, if you look at what happened, it is one of the two worries I have currently in the Senate system. It was bad in the 41st Parliament, but it hasn't been great in the 42nd or the 39th or in any other parliament. But if you have a look at it, and I've done some work here looking at Senate responses and how long it took for government responses to come through, they ranged, the shortest one in that period was 2 months. The longest one was 4 years and 3 months. This is around a three-month convention of responding to Senate reports. So I think that that's something we should look at together as a parliament, as a Senate, to see what we should do about that. There was great passion around the changes that happened to the committee system in 2006, and I think it is worthy of scrutiny. When Senator Evans committed strongly that he would revoke that should government change, when we did come to government in 2007, immediately in 2009, we actually made those changes. And there was, in fact, come to power in 2007, the Senate changes in 2008. So it was actually within a year that the changes were made to revert to the system that had been happening since 94. So there was a change back. It went through the Procedure Committee again. There was great discussion within the Procedure Committee and a report happened. Senator Jan McLucas actually moved the change to revert to the previous system in 2009 in the Senate, without debate. She moved it, and I don't think most people knew it had happened. And then we reverted to the system that was operating before 1994. So we need, I think, to be fair in our scrutiny. I enjoy working under the current system, and that's been the majority of my very short experience. Yesterday, Senator Knowles talked about her feeling that she had become a fossil with the amount of time she had in the Senate. Unfortunately, those fossiling tendencies seem to happen fairly quickly. And when I'm sitting in the Senate now with, you know, very short experience, 8 or 9 years, I can feel myself at times when newer senators from the opposition are getting really upset in estimates or in Senate inquiries about information they can't get, responses with which they're not happy, regulations that aren't there at the same time as the core legislation. And I sit there and I think, we never got those. And why should they get stuff that we didn't get? That's not the way of accountability. Senator Ray's comments around what goes around comes around probably is true. But what we should be doing in the current Senate is committing to ensure that what comes around is effective scrutiny, effective accountability, and goodwill.
Go on, Senator Minchin.
Thanks very much, John. Can I acknowledge my current and former Senate colleagues that are here today, and thank you for the opportunity to speak at this 40th anniversary Senate Committee conference, something worth celebrating. And I am pleased to speak, particularly in this session, based on my role as Deputy Leader of the Government in the Senate for the first 6 months of our majority and then as Leader of the Government in the Senate for the final 2 years of that majority. And I would note my deliberate reference to the coalition government having a majority for 2.5 years, in contrast to the description used in the title of this session, which refers to a government-controlled Senate. The reality is that the Liberal and National parties had a bare one-seat majority for 2.5 of the 11.5 years that the coalition held office. And given the right, the fundamental right of Liberal and National senators to cross the floor free of the risk of expulsion, quite unlike our opponents, the Australian Labor Party, then by no means is the term control at all appropriate, with great deference to the organisers of this conference. And indeed, being leader of the government for two and a half years of that bare majority was probably the most stressful period of my parliamentary life, because I knew, and every single one of my other 38 colleagues knew, that they individually could hold the government to ransom by holding a gun to the government's head on every single vote. And it was it required constant and determined effort on my part to make sure that I had 39 votes lined up on every single issue that came before the Senate. And indeed, like Claire, having gone back through the records, I observed that there were 23 separate occasions during that period where one or more coalition senators crossed the floor. So you could reasonably say I did a pretty lousy job as leader. And I do suspect that a Labor leader with a government majority would have a much easier life and could fairly be described as having control. So at the outset, I do want to dispute the presumption of government control of the Senate in that 2.5 years. Now, I do want to turn to exactly what occurred in that period with respect to the Senate committee system. I'm sure everybody here would agree that Odgers is the most authoritative source on Senate matters, and Odgers' description of the changes to the Legislation and General Purpose Committees, because that's what we're talking about, not all the rest of the committees, that were made in 2006 is as follows, and I quote, "In 2006, the pairs of committees in each subject area were amalgamated, returning to the pre-1994 arrangement for the Legislative and General Purpose Standing Committees," end quote, and that's it, and that is an entirely accurate description of what occurred. That is the one change that the Senate, with a Liberal National majority, made to the Senate committee system, to return to the pre-1994 arrangements with respect to the Legislation and General Purpose Standing Committees. There were no other changes proposed or implemented to any other Senate committees or any other arrangements to do with the Senate committee system. You could, of course, for those of you who were around at the time, be forgiven for thinking that something much more radical and much more dramatic had actually occurred. As I think Claire was hinting, the Labor Party took a massive egg-beater to this one change. Kim Beazley, the then opposition leader, actually had the gall to come out and describe it as evil, quote-unquote. The coalition government was accused by Labor of completely trashing the Senate committee system and destroying the accountability of government to the Senate. And frankly, it was the most extraordinarily over-the-top, ridiculous and ill-founded attack imaginable, and I have to say, with regret, entirely hypocritical. As Odgers actually confirms, what the Senate did in 2006 simply was to revert to the arrangements in place from 1970 to 1994, and thus for most of the period of the Hawke-Keating Labor government. And of course, I was in the Senate in 1994 when that long-standing arrangement, which everybody seemed happy with at the time, was changed. And the then Labor government was very cynical about the change to a split committee system. Claire has quoted Robert Ray in the 2006 debate. I was there in the 1994 debate when Senator Robert Ray, on behalf of the Labor government, said, and I quote, "There is no government ownership in any of this," in his contribution to the debate, and clearly questioned the motives behind that change. I know the motive very well because I sat as a humble new backbench senator in the coalition party room from mid-1993 onwards, where that split was given birth. The then opposition, the Liberal National Party opposition, didn't like the fact that the Labor government, then with only 30 out of 76 senators, I think the lowest number of senators that any government has probably ever had, chaired all the legislation and general purpose committees. The opposition, then with 36 senators, of course, chaired none. That meant Labor senators got the extra salaries and status of chairmanship, and opposition senators missed out entirely. Former Senator Noel Crichton-Brown, who some of you may have heard of, was then Deputy President of the Senate, and he led a very spirited campaign against this absolute outrage and wanted it fixed. And, of course, the way to fix it was to split those committees in two and create 8 extra chairmanships for non-government senators. Robert Ray knew as well as I did what the motive was, and hence his cynicism in the debate in 1994, and hence my cynicism about Labor's weeping and gnashing of teeth when the pre-1994 arrangements were reintroduced in 2006. This was exactly the system that Labor had had in government from 83 to 94 without any complaint, and yet in 2006 suddenly it was evil. Now, I must confess that with hindsight, I wish we'd never voted for the re-amalgamation of the split committees in 2006. We completely underestimated Labor's cynicism. We underestimated the media's compliant support of Labor's confected outrage, and we gave the opposition far too easy a stick to beat us over the head with. And the change, which, as I say, wasn't all that dramatic, really wasn't worth the completely manufactured and confected political trouble that then ensued. The momentum to revert to the pre-94 arrangement began in the coalition party room straight after that 2004 election, when the people had, by virtue of our results in two elections, given the coalition a majority, and was frankly unstoppable by the time I became leader at the beginning of 2006. And I may engender some dispute with the statement that I was quite sensitive as leader of the government to any suggestion of coalition abuse of our one-seat majority, and did go out of my way to ensure that we were not, and were not seen to be, guilty of such abuse. And indeed, I incurred the wrath of my National Party friends by resolutely opposing their plan to have a National Party senator elected deputy president of the Senate at that time, instead of the tradition of an opposition senator filling that office, and indeed had a robust argument with then Prime Minister Howard about that matter. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to ensure that, by and large, we did refrain from abuse of our majority. There was, of course, only one full calendar year when our government actually had a Senate majority. That was 2006. And in that year, and I think Claire referred to this, 98 bills were referred to Senate committees for inquiry and report, the highest number of bills ever referred in a calendar year up to that time, and double the annual average number of bills referred when Labor was last in government. We dedicated the tradition of now of four sitting weeks to estimates in 2006. Government ministers answered 1,100 questions without notice, 800 of them from non-government senators. And, of course, we didn't hold a candle to Labor on limited debate on bills. Labor still holds the record with the guillotine used for 57 bills on the 16th of June 1992 and 52 bills on the 13th of December 1990. From July 2005 to the end of 2006, the 18 months of our 2.5 years, the coalition used a time limitation for 32 bills in the face of obvious filibustering and didn't limit debate on any bills in 2007. And I think it is actually a pertinent and interesting fact that in the history of the Senate, over the, you know, whatever it is, 110 years, only 30 bills have had debates longer than 20 hours, and 15 of those 30 occurred under the Howard government. So I've no shame in saying that the coalition respected the practice and procedure of the Senate during that relatively brief period of our government majority, and the one change to the committee system that did occur was simply to revert to the arrangements for the legislation and general purpose committees that operated from 1970 to 1994. And indeed, we ensured that opposition senators would be the deputy chairs of those committees, and for the first time, we ensured that they would be remunerated for being deputy chairs. So the motivation for the 2006 change was largely a function of what we saw as an abuse of the split system by the other parties. As is well known, the intention of splitting the committees in two in 1994 was to have legislation go to the legislation committees, chaired by a government senator, and references go to a reference committee chaired by a non-government senator. What we experienced after we came to government in 1996 was the cynical practice of referring legislation, referring bills, to the references committees, a complete corruption of the intent behind the split system. From 1996 to 2005, legislation was referred to references committees instead of the legislation committees on 46 separate occasions. so as to ensure committees run by non-government parties would deal with the bills in question. So that flagrant abuse of the 1994 changes was the primary motivation for the Coalition to support a reversion to the pre-94 arrangement. Following the defeat of our government in 2007 and the loss of our majority on 1 July 2008, the Procedure Committee again, as Claire said, examined the structure of the Legislation and General Purpose Committees. And as Leader of the Opposition at that time, I was a member of the Procedure Committee. The April 2009 report of the committee accurately records the basis of the committee recommendation, subsequently adopted by the Senate to reinstate the 94 arrangements. Importantly, I think the committee noted that one of the motivations for the 94 changes had been to reduce the need for the appointment of select committees, effectively by having the separate references committees do that work. In 2008-2009, under the scheme of unified committees, eight select committees were appointed. And the Procedure Committee, I think, wisely advised that in recommending a return to split committees, no more than three select committees should exist at any one time. The committee also sensibly advised that there should be an understanding that bills be referred only to legislation committees, thus dealing with what I referred to before as the previous abuse of the split system. So, ladies and gentlemen, the one change that was made to the committee system under the Coalition Senate majority has, with Coalition support, now been erased, and we're back where we were in 1994. Now, this session is entitled Lessons from that period, 2005 to 2008. I'm not sure what they are, but I suppose the big lesson for me is never to underestimate the capacity of your opponents to indulge in scaremongering and hyperbole and hypocrisy in relation to Senate committees. And I do hope that the Senate has learned that if the spirit of the 94 changes had been observed between 96 and 2005, then the quite unsavoury confrontation and political point scoring of 2006 could well have been avoided. I think it's also an experience that reminds us that whatever system we have in place, the opposition of the day, whether it's Labor or Liberal or whatever, will always be motivated to use the Senate committee system to embarrass the government of the day. That's just the political reality, that partisanship will always reign supreme. But I hope the reality of this period, 2005 to 2007, also demonstrates that it is wrong to believe that no government should ever even have the opportunity to be a majority in the Senate. I think the point is, and I know others have said it, that the committee system is robust and the institution of the Senate is sufficiently robust. And after, I must say, after the enlargement of the Senate in 1983, a function of certain parties wanting more houses in the lower house, but being caught by the Constitution, which requires the Senate to be half the size of the House, I, for one, thought that no government would ever again achieve a Senate majority. And we did surprise ourselves at the 2004 election when a one-seat majority was achieved. And I simply want to state here today that I do think we used that one-seat majority responsibly. Government Senate majorities are going to remain extremely rare. But I think it right and proper that it remain at least possible under the electoral system with sufficient voter support for a majority to be attained. In fact, may I conclude by saying that with the formal alliance between the Labor and Greens entered into by Prime Minister Gillard and Senator Bob Brown, one could reasonably argue that from 1 July 2011 there will again be a government majority in the Senate and even, dare I say, government control. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Minchin. We have about 5 minutes for questions. Dean Magetz?
Thank you. Just curious, I noticed when I was in the Senate that there was a particular difference in Senate and committees between the lower house and the upper house, in as much as the lower house committees often had people coming in to the secretariat who were under the control of ministers. they came from departments rather than be independent. And I'm wondering whether there's any of that that has occurred or changed, because theoretically you're meant to have independent people who aren't just employed to conduct committees, because otherwise they will feel that they'll need to please governments to get employed to be on the secretariat. Has there been any change in that? I certainly was on a joint committee where there was someone from defence under the control of the defence minister, and it's only the senators who understood there was an issue there. So is there any... have there been any changes to the secretariats, that is, secretariats that are employed the whole year round, or who come from departments and just participate in a particular inquiry?
Dee, I think that question is more appropriately directed to the clerk of the Senate. but certainly as a senator, no, there hasn't. I think we are blessed with very high standard of secretariats in the Senate committee system, and I wasn't conscious of the observation you made about the House, but that's certainly not the case in the Senate from my experience.
Dee, I think the Joint Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee does have a formal arrangement with having people from the military serve a period of time on that committee, working in that committee. But that would be probably the one to which you're referring, but we're unaware of anything like that, and certainly no contravention of the independence of the way the Senate committees operate.
Would you like to make a comment on that?
Sure.
Assistant table in the Department of the House of Representatives. I think what the former senator may have been referring to is our practice of having secondees work with us in our secretariats. We have a fully staffed secretariat or committee office in the Department of the House of Representatives supporting our committees, but on occasions we do use secondees from departments. When secondees work with us, they work very much as staff within the Department of the House of Representatives, and they do not are not answerable to ministers. In terms of the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Joint Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, we do have a military advisor on attachment to that committee, as the Senator said, and that role is very much a professional advisorial role. It isn't one of accountability to the minister. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. If I could just add, that practice also exists with the Department of the Senate. There have been a couple of secretaries of Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee, I recall, been seconded from AGs and from time to time research officer level people are seconded from departments. Are there any other questions? We've got time for one more question. Senator, yes.
Ex-senators dominating question time here. Many things I could say to that speeches, but I shan't. I shall just ask questions. One was to Senator Minchin, the statistic, and I know statistics have their problems in terms of comparisons, but I think you said 23 times crossing the floor in that period. I guess firstly, how many of those were Barnaby Joyce? And secondly, more relevantly, I guess, how does that compare? You probably don't know off the top of your head, but I guess you probably have a rough idea how that compares with the number of floor crossings.
The coalition senators, noble tradition, I might say, in the time when the Fraser government nominally had a majority. And I guess in terms of Tim Blair or perhaps both of you, in terms of the issue of at least reducing the problem of the dynamics that in effect the effectiveness of Senate committees when the government nominally has control, the notion that's been raised, I think, a number of times over the years about whether the Senate should not have ministers, I guess asking Blair, because fairly say to someone who don't see yourself as being there to try to become a minister, and I think that's part of why you're a very effective chair. Not the only reason, but one. Is there some merit in looking at that? Because that's the problem that can come, doesn't always come, it can come where suitable for higher service can be restored.
There was some discussion of that yesterday, Andrew, and I mean, my own view is that we should have senators who have the opportunity to serve in every capacity, and the history of senators who are ministers on all sides of Parliament is very strong. And I think someone said yesterday it gave a certain edginess to the debate. I'm not sure whether they're the words I've used, but the whole concept of having good government and good Parliament means that the people who can best serve are able to serve. So looking both in my extensive experience, when I was in opposition, I thought that the senators from the government at that stage were able and effective senators and brought their cases effectively, and I think the Labor ministers do the same. So I think we should have that. And it is a shared government process. So the government of the day is in the House of Reps and the Senate. And this is a minister from the Senate who may have a personal view about the situation.
Well, just briefly, yeah, I second that. and I do think it is important that senators have the opportunity to serve as ministers, and I don't know quite how the business of government would be handled in the absence of ministers entirely from the Senate. But what you find is that certain senators on both sides set themselves on endeavouring to become members of the executive. Others make the quite deliberate decision they don't want to follow that career path. They want to be good legislators and pursue, you know, a legislative career. And I think that's healthy. What matters is both parties being able to attract high-calibre people to the Senate. I actually think that the absence of any opportunity to serve in government would have a deleterious effect on the quality of senators that the parties could attract, frankly. Just in relation to your first question, Andrew, it's nice to be reminded of being asked questions by Senator Bartlett back in the old days. Look, that was a cheeky question, and I wouldn't want to bring personalities into this matter. I think that'd be quite unfair. But certain senators, did cross the floor more than once. That's certainly true. Indeed, my predecessor is Senate Government Leader Robert Hill was one of the most prolific floor crossers in the Fraser years, you might recall. But I think that's the point about there is a qualitative difference between a Labor government having a Senate majority and a Liberal National Coalition having a Senate majority because of this fundamental difference between our two parties on the question of the right of senators or members of the House of Reps to cross the floor. It simply doesn't happen in the Labor Party, but as you've observed and I did, it does happen quite a lot on our side.
We'll have to wrap it up. We're about 5 minutes over time. But I would ask you to thank our speakers in this session.